I'm Rob Califf, and I want to welcome you to another episode of Life and Times of Cardiologist. As all of you know, I've had a lot of fun over the last several years interviewing well-known people in cardiology, people who have had an inspiring influence on young people, delving into their histories. And I had the pleasure last night of spending a little time with Bill Roberts, who I really am trying to emulate with this video version of what he used to do in the American Journal of Cardiology. And I was a subject of one of his interviews, and a lot of people read it and commented they learned a lot about me that was useful in a variety of ways from that. So today I'm fortunate to have with me Paul Ridker, who I think everybody knows has had a huge influence on the field of cardiology, has garnered a lot of accolades for good reason. And Paul, welcome to the show.
Rob, it's fun to do this, and actually I think you're right. I think Bob's article is really interesting, and you're doing a video. Is this an update of that? So it's great.
So let's go back to the origins of Paul Ridker. Tell us about where you grew up and what your family is like, the family you grew up with.
Well, actually, I had a fairly interesting childhood. I was born in St. Louis. My dad was an economics professor at Wash U, and my mom's actually an artist. But what was interesting growing up is that I consider Washington, D.C. my home, because my dad was in the Foreign Service, and so we grew up overseas a fair amount of the time. And my parents were clearly children of the 60s. They were, I'll give you the best example, is 1967. You may remember the Beatles went off to India, so my parents went off to India. I was in third grade. My older sister, was in fourth grade. And we packed up and moved to Delhi, which is a lot different then than it is now. And so my dad's career was in the Foreign Service. As an economist doing population demography, population development. And it gave us as kids a real view of the world. So Washington, D.C., and then living overseas back and forth was how we grew up.
Just the one sister, or were there other children in the family?
There's just the two of us. My sister's an architect. She's still in Washington, D.C. I'm the only one that went away and didn't come back home.
What other countries did you live in besides India?
Well, India was for a full 2 years. But the family traveled a lot. And that gave us the opportunity to be in a lot of different places. And actually, one of the great things, as you know, about a career in academic cardiology is the travel we do in our professional lives. And it's been a real blessing to me to be able to take my kids all over the world. It's a great part of this job.
Tell me a little bit about what India was like. As you know, I'm spending a little time in India myself now, and really learning a lot, I think, from it. But it must have been amazing back in those days.
Well, I've had the opportunity to go back to India a couple of times since. Now there's a subway in New Delhi, as you know, and Mumbai is this enormous city. In the 60s, India was it was pretty third world. And I was an embassy brat, so we got to live in a very nice place. But the country was fabulous in terms of people, food, culture, music, history, art. But we had people living on the street in front of our house. So the dichotomies of India that you still see a bit when you get outside the major cities, or if you, depending on where you go in those cities, back then was everywhere. There really weren't nice places. It was pretty much straightforward. I also remember when we arrived in India, when we left Washington, D.C., our moving van was a moving van. We arrived in India, it was a bullet cart, you know. And I still remember, when the plane landed, they first did a sweep of the runway to get the cows off, and then came back around to land the plane. And that's changed a lot, obviously.
It's amazing now to see, they say 100,000 people a month are moving from poverty to middle class in India now.
It is extraordinary. I was in Mumbai just a couple of months ago, still the enormous poverty, but something very different. In the poorest areas, kids had clothing, people seemed to have food, and quite remarkably and so impressive to me, kids were going to school, whereas 20 years ago, they would have been 0-3. And I think, you know, education is the key to this whole thing. And seeing people at least having survival levels of food, having clothing on their back, and watching the children with a school book, I think it's a pretty good future.
Now, what kind of things were you personally interested in as a kid growing up? Were you a science nut, or were you a sports freak, or what? How'd you characterize yourself?
Yeah, I liked school, I have to admit. Always have been a student in the broader sense of the word. Did a lot of athletics growing up. Still play a lot of tennis now in my adult life. Played fairly seriously when I was younger. But I think also I was one of those kids who in high school was very interested in science. I'll tell you an interesting story that I think will surprise you. So this experience of how you grow up and what it ends up doing to you is very real. I think it's okay to talk about this here. When I was in India, I actually got sick as a kid. When we came back to the United States, my parents had a dilemma. They very much wanted to go back, but their son was having some issues medically. So I got referred as a kid to the NIH. Hmm. So my personal experience of what doctors do was formed when I was 12, 13, 14 years old. Was I thought everybody did research on really interesting problems. there's a physician at the NIH, a guy named Warren Strober. He's still there in the mucosal immunity branch. And he was my personal research scientist doc. I think that was my introduction to medicine, was being, you know, a kid with a problem that I never would have gotten if I hadn't lived in India. Never been a problem living here. But I really, really thought for a long time that everybody did this mix between science, research, and that was how I ended up where I am.
I mean, think about it, it's quite an unusual exposure having parents with their interests as you did, your dad being a university professor, and then being exposed to medicine at the NIH of all places.
Well, one of the interesting things is that my first appearance in the New England Journal of Medicine is as a patient.
Wow.
There's a case report published mid-1970s of a certain immunodeficiency that, again, doesn't really matter that much. Now they probably would think I had something awful. But back then, and I'm there as the patient. And again, it struck me that this is what people did in medicine.
Were you actually identified?
No.
No HIPAA violation?
No, I'm just no HIPAA violation. I'm just patient X. But it's a really interesting kind of thing to see the NIH from the living in Building 10 point of view. We used to go up to the top of Building 10. They have a basketball court up there. They got ping pong tables up there. My blood became very useful for a number of people's research careers.
So that's
for
amazing.
Years. Yeah. But I got a summer job at the NIH, partly because they probably wanted my blood. And that summer job was in immunology. And I'm pretty convinced the reason I do sort of this mix between inflammation biology and cardiology is partly because I had a fundamental interest in immunology going way back to these childhood issues.
So when did you know you wanted to be a doctor? Was it all the way back then?
No, about maybe sophomore, junior year in college, I kind of figured out I was pretty good at this stuff, doing well, and I had kept up with these physicians at the NIH over the years. I thought I was going to actually do basic science. I thought that was where I was heading. And then medicine, and I think the people part of medicine sort of kicked in. And
where did you go to college?
I went to Brown.
Why did you pick Brown?
My sister was there.
Ah.
No, really. My sister, who's an architect now, we were very close, still very close. And I wanted to go to school. My sister was. I really did. And she got in, so it made it easier for me.
What did you major in?
At Brown, back then, they had this thing called the open curriculum. And as I indicated, my mom is an artist. I did most of my senior year at RISD, the Rhode Island School of Design. By then, I knew I was going to medical school. So I stopped taking science classes, and I actually did furniture design.
Furniture design.
For my senior thesis at Brown was I built a desk, a very nice desk. Thought about a career in woodworking for about 6 months. That would not have worked out real well.
Do you still have an interest in furniture? And
you know, when we moved into our current house, I did build a small shop in the basement, but it is time-consuming. So now my interest is mostly looking at furniture when I'm at museums and things like that, but it's so time-consuming to do it.
Now, was there anyone, either in high school or college, that was an inspiration to you when you were coming through? Someone who changed your view? And obviously, this doctor at the NIH was critical to you.
Well, this guy, Warren Strober, really was critical. Because, as I say, he was not only my physician, but he's a fundamental basic scientist, MD, PhD type, who spent his entire career. And what's remarkable to me is that he's still very active at the NIH. He still runs his lab. And I think that was very inspirational, his idea that he's still, and actually he would say he's doing as good science now as he ever did. And I think that's great to see. That was very, very important.
What about in college?
Well, college was a bit of a mixed bag from a science point of view. By the time I figured I did want to go to medical school, I started doing other things. I come from a family that's very literary. My children are heading off in literary directions. And as I said, my mom's an artist, my sister's an architect, and so college became a sense of, okay, I'm going in this direction, I'm spending my college time doing something else. It wasn't really until later on that the rest of it started to kick in.
And where'd you go to medical school?
So I went to Harvard Medical School.
Was that your aspiration? Did you want to be a Harvard person? Or?
No, I was kind of shocked when they took me, actually. And in fact, I got in off the wait list, so I think I was on the lower end of what they were expecting anyway. Ended up obviously being a great experience. But I still was really very unsure about what I wanted to do. I almost went into surgery. I think that was the woodworking part of me. That was the hands-on, I can build stuff part. And then I had that panic that I see a lot of young students having, which is sort of third year of school's rolling around, you have no idea what you want to do. And I was very, very fortunate. I got a fellowship to go overseas for a year. So I spent between third and fourth year, I had an extra year there, where I actually went to Zimbabwe, went back to do what I thought would be development work. And I was being driven because another close friend, a guy named Moshe Eflat, who's now in Israel, but at the time was my parasitology professor at Harvard, I thought I was going to be an ID doc. I had these infectious issues when I was a kid. I was interested in immunology. So I went to Zimbabwe for a year to do what I thought would be parasitology, infectious disease work. But that happened to be collinear with the AIDS epidemic exploding. So this would have been 79, 80. So I ended up actually being a physician essentially in two different refugee camps at a time when I wasn't ready to be a physician yet. And so it was a very steep learning curve. But I ended up being really a fantastic year, learning a lot about, healthcare in the third world, but also a lot about how chronic diseases also affect that part of the world.
That's fascinating. So you it sounds like you had these experiences, but basically you were sailing through medical school doing well and probably had a lot of options thinking about infectious disease. Why on earth would you go from being an ID person to a cardiologist?
Oh, that's Gene Brownwell. So I got to the Brigham for internship, And I still thought I was going to be an infectious disease physician. There was no doubt about it, actually. But, Dr. Brownwell, back then when he was chairman, had these end-of-the-year chats he'd have with the interns. And he said, what are you going to do? And I said, infectious disease. He said, no, you're going to be a cardiologist. So I said, okay.
How did he come to that conclusion?
I don't know. He's just, and how he could be so convincing is the other thing. But that's him. It's really, as you know, quite remarkable to watch his ability to create people, almost.
I'm trying to envision the session. So you go in and he just tells you you're going to be a cardiologist, and you shocked?
It was Dr. Brownwell. You said, yes, sir, I'd be happy to. And it was a great idea. Yeah. And Tom Smith also was very influential. So, my mentors there were really Tom Smith, who pulled me into the cardiology fellowship, Charlie Hennekins, who you know real well, who was my epidemiology mentor. And I did find in this mix this ability to sort of do the part of infectious disease I was really interested in was this population biology issue. and bringing that into, and the inflammation infectious piece. So the fact that what I kind of do is this hybrid between cardiovascular disease and inflammation to me makes total sense because of these various kind of exposures along the way.
Well, the Tom Smith effect is, I can understand that being profound too. I had the fun of the last year of his life, we were designing the Reynolds program, and we spent a lot of time together. I mean, the dedication he had to science, but also just to life, was amazing. He would get his, he was dying of mesothelioma, I guess, and he would get his lung drained, and then we'd go out and play a round of golf. While he could breathe, and it was just remarkable to me to see how he.
Yeah, Tom was a truly remarkable guy, and you're absolutely right. As ill as he got, he came to the hospital to work every day, came to grounds. Nothing stopped him, and it was actually very inspirational for those of us who knew him before he got ill, and then watched this process of a man whose life was so dedicated to the science part of what being a physician is all about. Very impressive.
So you got Dr. Brownwell changed your career aspirations, and you dedicated yourself then to being a cardiologist, and obviously it worked. Why did you stay at Harvard for your whole career?
Well, my wife would say I'm just lazy. I've had one beeper number, and I can't hold on to a lot of numbers in my head, so it's made life a lot easier. The real reason is because at every step of the way when you make those decisions, doors kept opening at the Brigham. And that, again, was what Tom Smith did, is what Gene did, is what Charlie Hennigan's did. I remember going to that group and saying that I wanted to do this thing that would be sort of what we now call molecular epidemiology, and now genetic, but it didn't really exist. But Charlie Hennigan's obviously had this epidemiology shop inside the Brigham, so there was a very good epidemiologist in the backyard who was very happy to train me, and so they kept on. Making it too difficult to leave is the real answer to you.
Did you know when you started your fellowship that you were going to do cardiovascular epidemiology? When you're saying it's consistent with your...
I think I did. I had an idea. But again, you know, it's family influences. My father is an economic demographer. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing, just in medicine. Yeah. What he was doing was population economics. And I did like math. And
are your parents still living?
Yes, they both are. And they're doing well, thank goodness. Yeah,
that's great. And tell me about your wife. When did you meet?
So you'll chuckle at this. My wife Susan. I met her because Harlan Krumholtz and I moved into Harvard Medical School simultaneously, same day. And there's this very cute woman helping him move his stuff in. So Harlan is my brother-in-law. We share lots of nieces and nephews together. And so you can imagine cardiology dinners at our house and getting together for Passover with Harlan in a few weeks down at his place in Connecticut are very interesting affairs. My wife at the time was a senior at Wellesley College, and the Krumholtz family had a car that was parked out at Wellesley, so there was a good excuse to go out there. And then Susan went off to do graduate work in French. And my wife now teaches French to 7th graders in the Wellesley school system, and she's a fabulous teacher and just loves it.
That's great. And what, kids?
Yeah, 7th graders. Oh, my kids.
Your kids.
Yes,
yeah.
No, my kids. I've got two terrific kids. My eldest is Andrew, who's a sophomore now at Wash U, who I'm very proud to say is he's on his way to Oxford next year to do a literary fellowship. He's a very literary guy in poetry and theater, and it's actually great to have a kid who just kind of turns your intellectual lights on. And my daughter Elena is a senior in high school, and she's on her way to Dartmouth, and she's a terrific kid who just is good at everything, frankly, and a great athlete, actually.
Is she going to play sports in college?
She's not. I got to give her a lot of credit for this. When we did the college tour, she said, "Dad, I'm kind of done with that. I want to turn on the other part of my life now." And wasn't our influence at all. She decided she wasn't interested in seeing the gym. She wanted to see the libraries, the theater, the student activities, the improv groups. It's great to see a kid kind of make that shift.
Yeah,
and it was
really
fun.
That really sounds nice. So, one of the interesting things to me, at least, and I'm interested in your views on this. You got married, and you've been married a long time. not many in my medical school class are still married to the same person that they were married to at the during medical school. How about yours?
I will be married to Susan for a long time coming. For what it's worth, in my one experience, she and I were very good friends before we got married. I think that somehow or another over the years has been the real issue, is that you know, there's always that physical attraction thing and all that stuff, but I think at the end of the day, you know, your intellectual equal, someone who challenges you. Susan's a fantastic reader. I mean, I think the French literature part of her life, and someone who brings that sort of cultural issues and those challenges and the way you think. And I don't know whether this is good or bad, but I'm glad she's not in medicine. Makes going home. But I know that's not going to change.
So maybe in the last part of the interview, we can talk a bit about what happened after you went into this field and how you see it evolving, and some ideas that you might leave people with as they're thinking about their futures. I mean, when you started, as you say, you had Tom Smith, who was an amazing, I just think of him as a cardiovascular biologist for you, and dealt a lot with immunology. Hennekin's one of the world's best epidemiologists. You sort of merged the two. A lot of us from the outside can't figure out the Harvard system. It seems like a feudal system with a lot of things that overlap and mix together, and it's not a nice set of departments, you know, like a lot of places have that easily are understandable. How did you craft a career out of that?
Well, I might say it's not as planned as it probably looks. I think that's the first piece. Rob, I've been very lucky in many ways. If you really think about what I've been doing for almost 20 years now, it's almost been one question. I've really been interested in how do we figure out why this inflammation thing seems so important to heart disease? How do we come up with a way of measuring inflammation? How do you do the clinical translational piece? How do you design clinical trials that you've been so phenomenally successful with and use them as pathophysiologic tools, not just to answer the clinical question, but to sort of ask what's the underlying biology and how do you take that to the next step? And in a way, I've been very blessed because, as you know, people can work very, very hard and it just doesn't work out. This was one of those instances where you're working very, very hard, but it seemed one step led to the next experiment, to the point now where we can actually ask in our current studies, not can I use inflammation to identify people at high risk who I might have otherwise missed, but now I can ask, can we actually give targeted anti-inflammatory therapies as the intervention to try to lower that risk? And so there's two big studies that we're running now are using, one uses an interleukin beta monoclonal antibody to see if we can actually inhibit inflammation directly with that approach. The other is our NIH-funded study that's going to start enrolling in a few months, looking at using, you know, methotrexate, the same drug we use for rheumatoid arthritis. But to do those studies required a step-by-step basis of pieces of the puzzle coming together. And I've always said that one of the best things you can do as a scientist is be lucky. And I'll go all the way back to Charlie Hennekin's again. You know, the first paper we wrote that I thought was probably important was our first observation about CRP predicting events. But remember, that was done inside Charlie's aspirin trial. Mm-hmm. That was pure serendipity, because that was where I was working, and he had done this magnificent study showing if it took aspirin, it reduced risk. But it was an anti-inflammatory drug. And we had this inflammatory biomarker, and the benefit of the aspirin was greater. And light bulbs went off and said, wow, could we ever imagine leveraging this inflammation piece? Now, that was 1997, so it takes a while to get there. But I think working on one fundamental problem has made it awfully fun.
So if you were to give people advice now, thinking, let's say your middle year cardiology fellows and they're considering a career, what would you tell them to think about now? How should they look at it?
You know, I may be a bit of a Pollyanna about this, but there's nothing else I'd actually rather do. I love taking care of people. I could have done that and really enjoyed it. But this ability to mix, as you do, to be able to mix different kinds of issues, to do research, also to take care of people, there's nothing else I'd rather do. And so I try to tell people, look, don't worry so much about the changes you see going around medicine, everything will work itself out. If you're driven by this desire to think about a problem and think about how it's going to help your patient, just do this. I mean, it's not going to go away. And I don't know. I think things do work out in the long run.
In your current environment, what is it like? What's the structure that you work in? Come to work every day. You must have a big team of people that get all this done.
So I am fortunate. I have some terrific people. I've got some junior folks who are presenting some terrific abstracts here. Brendan Everett did a great job this morning. Sammy Amora, Aruna Pradhan, Michelle Albert. Lots of people. We've got a whole genetics group now run by a great computational biologist, Dan Chasman. But we have a research group that sits actually in the Division of Preventive Medicine, which is actually Joanne Manson's shop. Most of the people in my part of this are cardiologists, so they also have a dual appointment with Peter Libby in cardiovascular medicine. So they do their clinical work there, their research work with me. This is all housed in something called the Center for Cardiovascular Disease Prevention, which really was a creation that Victor Zhao helped me to work out, so we had a place to put these people in a way to sort of keep the grants in one area. But Harvard is a funny place that way. It was a structure built in order to allow this to happen, not vice versa. Yeah.
Right. I think there may be a lesson there in how people currently think about things is so structured that maybe by creating places for innovation that are separated out a little bit might be a good thing to do.
It certainly worked well in our case. I think the freedom to pursue a scientific idea free of the structural problems, as long as you get grant money to pay for it, has worked out well.
So last thing I'll ask you is give me a prediction on what's going to happen with your inflammation theory and modification of inflammation. You have two trials going on now. Where's all this headed?
Well, the perfect outcome would be that they both work, that we demonstrate that two different pathways of inhibiting inflammation lead to lower cardiovascular event rates. Now, my guess is that the methotrexate study has the best observational data. Remember, patients, rheumatoid arthritis patients getting methotrexate have lower vascular event rates, but it's probably a fairly toxic way of getting there since it's fairly nonspecific. The canakinumab approach, I think, is going to be very safe. The question was, will it be effective? If they're both effective, I think it's going to be an enormous win, because what will immediately happen is, A, we'll have different ways of treating people, but it will trigger an enormous amount of really sophisticated biology to say, okay, if these two broad-based approaches to inhibiting inflammation work so well, where's the real target and how do we get there? And with the canakinumab experience, since it's a sub-Q drug, it could actually be a very therapeutic approach, which would be very exciting. There were two interesting papers in The Lancet just last week about interleukin-6 pathways and changes in that pathways leading to a drop in CRP, a drop in fibrinogen, and a drop in event rates. That's great, because that's what both of these trials do is they lower IL-6. And so from a biologic perspective, there's a lot of excitement there. Both trials will have gene banks. They'll both have a lot of other science built in. But if one or both works, it's going to be a real change for us.
Well, I hope it does work. It'd be great for patients and would lead, as you say, to a lot of new biology. So, Paul, thanks for taking the time. I think people will get a lot out of this interview, things to think about for the future for themselves.
Well, Rob, thank you for doing these programs. I think they're a lot of fun.